available on digital media, iTunes podcast, smartphone apps, and from the online website. This is Outlook, the talking newspaper for Coventry.
Outlook. I'm Peter Walton, so this edition is being recorded on the 6th of March 2024. Coming up in today's programme, we're hearing about leap years. We've just had one, of course, every 4 years. We're remembering the great late Barry Humphreys. We're looking at origins of words and phrases, but also accents this time, as from Susie Dent. And we have the memories of a military wife from Joe Davis. All that plus our usual features, post-play and sport. But first of all, here's the news with the readers, myself and Elaine.
Outlook News.
The Department for Work and Pensions is sending letters to millions of people telling them they will soon get more money. Every April, the DWP updates people about their pensions and benefits, and this year there's good news. Lots of older people who get the new or basic state pension are in for a boost, as most payments will jump by 8.5% from April the 8th. If you are on the full new state pension, your weekly cash will rise from £203.85 to £221.20. For those on the full old or basic state pension, your weekly amount will increase from £156.20 to £169 per week. However, Lord Davis of Brixton pointed out that not all parts of the state pension will see an 8.5% rise. Only the bit that goes up with wages, known as the triple lock, will get this boost. He said everything else in the state pension will go up by September's Consumer Price Index inflation rate, which was 6.7%. Lord Davis said, "The everything else is not trivial. It is all the additional pensions that people earned while they were in the state second pension, the retained rights that they retained when the new state pension was introduced, and the additional pensions that people gained because they deferred their state pension." He added, "There's not much talk about the other parts of the state pension," pointing out that not many people get only the new or basic state pension.
British Gas has announced an extension of its Peak Save Sundays scheme, where customers can take advantage of half-price electricity every Sunday. The scheme, which was due to end on February the 29th, will now run until March the 31st, between 11 a.m. and 4 p.m. To participate, customers must have a smart meter installed and their electricity usage will be tracked during the event. British Gas will then reimburse half of the cost incurred. "We're proud partners of Team GB and Paralympics GB, but you don't have to wait until the Paris 2024 Games to enjoy a big event. We're running one every Sunday until the end of March with half-price electricity from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. for our world-class peak savers," the company said.
Martin Lewis, famous for helping people save money on his TV show, has told everyone to buy stamps before April. His website says that the price of first-class stamps will go up by 8% from the 2nd of April. Royal Mail will also make other stamps more expensive, like second-class stamps, which will cost 13% more. But if you get stamps now, you can still use them even after they get more expensive. From the 2nd of April 2024, standard first-class stamps will cost £1.35 instead of £1.25. Large first-class stamps will be £2.10, up from £1.95. Both are going up by 8%. Second-class stamps will cost 85p, which is 10p more than now, which is 13% increase. But large second-class stamps will stay at £1.55. You can send letters that weigh up to 100 grams with these stamps. Mr. Lewis said, "For years, Every time stamps go up in price, I've suggested people stock up and bulk buy in advance, as, provided the stamp doesn't have a price on it, and instead just says the postage class, it is still valid after the hike. This has been an effective tactic, as a first-class letter stamp is now £1.25, soon to be rising to £1.35, but in 2012 it was just 60p, so you may as well stock up now.
Coventry City Council is set to spend more money on turning the city's old IKEA store into a cultural centre. It will cover a rise in construction costs for the project, a report said. But the figure involved has not been revealed. Councillors will be asked to sign off on the move at meetings later this month. Plans to turn the huge building into a place for national collections were first announced in 2021. More details were unveiled last year, including plans for Coventry University to turn the top floors into a cultural hub. Councillors also agreed for the council to spend a certain amount on construction and professional fees for the project at a meeting last year. This figure was also kept private for confidentiality reasons. But construction costs have risen, and the council now has to fill a shortfall. It comes after the project hit several problems, a report for a meeting next week revealed. These included a drop in interest from contractors due to economic and market conditions and higher tender costs, though these have now been somewhat reduced. Both led the council and its partners in the project to consider their options, including scrapping it altogether at one point. But they agreed to move ahead and will each plug funding gaps in the scheme. Coventry City Council is also proposing to spend more money fitting out the first two floors to be rented out more quickly. It's also considering using the outside decks of the floors as a permit-only car park for 250 cars. The potential income from these floors could fund the shortfall, the report said. Officers are recommending that councillors approve the extra money at council and cabinet meetings this month, including next week. If members decided not to go ahead with it, the overall project would be shut down, the report added.
Coventry's Belgrade Theatre has revealed a fresh new look as part of a plan to create work inspired by local communities. The new brand, unveiled under the slogan "Sharing Coventry's Stories Since 1958, was presented by Creative Director Corey Campbell and Chief Executive Laura Elliott last Thursday. The event included performances, interviews with community-based project partners, and a short promotional film for the revamped website. The theatre's new look was created after extensive discussions with stakeholders, including audiences, local artists, staff, trustees, funders, and partners across education, healthcare, and the arts industry. This is part of a new business plan aimed at enhancing the theatre's reputation by 2030. The theatre says its history as a post-war symbol of peace and reconciliation, named after the Serbian capital's gift of timber, is strongly emphasised in this vision. The theatre is well known for its work in theatre in education and is involved in community projects. Last year, it was announced that there would be a major expansion of production capacity, including five new roles running programmes across the city. Future artistic work on this new vision is already underway or in development. The launch event also coincided with Seaview, a three-part urban sci-fi drama being streamed on Amazon Prime. This 2021 City of Culture project, developed by Corey Campbell during the pandemic, was shot predominantly in Coventry. The theatre says that following the best attended pantomime in decades, popular touring shows continue to grow at the Belgrade with record numbers of new and returning audiences since the lockdown period. Further co-productions are in progress, and there are also tours of The Woman in Black, Shrek the Musical, Sister Act, and The Return of Six, which they say are proving popular with new and long-standing audiences. Laura Elliott, the chief executive, added her thoughts, saying, "In 1958, the Belgrade Theatre opened as part of the redevelopment of a city still healing from collective trauma, as a piece of vital municipal infrastructure for the people of Coventry and our wider region. With our new plan, it will be as much a resource for health and well-being, education and career development, as it is a space for entertainment."
Coventry residents have criticised plans to build a demonstrator track for Coventry Very Light Rail, saying it's not futuristic and it's something we don't need. If plans are approved, work to build the track will start in the autumn. The first part could be finished by early 2025. CVLR is made up of a battery-powered vehicle and an ultra-thin track, which aims to be zero emission and cheaper than a conventional tram. However, passengers won't be able to use the battery-powered vehicle to travel around, as the aim is to show the system works in practice. The track will be built into two parts, with the first half ending at the old IKEA building and going from Warwick Road near Coventry Rail Station to Millennium Place, where the Coventry Transport Museum is located. Once funding is available, work on the second part of the route will likely start in 25-26. The project aims for the installation and manufacturing process to be carried out with as little disruption as possible at a cost of around £10 million per kilometre. The plans also include installing the track on precast concrete slabs, which will be craned into place before standard surfacing and final quality checks are given the go-ahead. Most junctions will stay the same, but a signal control junction will replace the roundabout at Central 6 Retail Park. Residents shared their view of a potential CVLR track coming to the city. One said, "VLR is not driverless, so exactly what is the difference between VLR and an electric bus? Except that VLR requires expensive track and other infrastructure, whereas electric buses already exist and work without extra costs." Another questioned why a plan like this was needed in the city centre. Firstly, you could walk from the train station to Poolmeadow in 10 minutes. Secondly, we already have electric buses that go that route. However, others disagreed, saying the demonstrated track is to show how a light railway can be viable. "This isn't about getting people from A to B in Coventry. It's a demonstrator to show other cities such a light railway is viable, hopefully, so that they can buy them, and that creates jobs in Coventry to manufacture them."
An amazing Coventry woman is behind fundraisers in Coventry who are hoping to reach a whopping £2 million milestone for Cancer Research UK. The Coventry Local Committee of Cancer Research UK, which nearly had to close 20 years ago, is just £3,000 short of hitting the fantastic £2 million mark. The group was formed in 1978 and faced a crisis in 2004 when it looked like it might have to close because there weren't enough members. But Mal Haddon from Eastern Green, Coventry, who lost her mum to esophageal cancer in 1994, stepped up and took on the roles of chairman, secretary and treasurer. Since then, the group has gone from strength to strength, working tirelessly to reach their 2 million goal by hosting events like collections and craft sales. The committee, made up of Mal and a few of her friends, is asking anyone who would like to help to get in touch and help them reach their target. Ryan Good, the charity's fundraising spokesperson for Coventry and Warwickshire, added, "We're fighting over 200 types of cancer, and for the last 20 years, the unwavering dedication of the Coventry Local Committee has helped drive forward research that is unlocking new and better ways to beat it. Every day we see the benefits of work the charity has previously funded being realised, with new clinical trials opening and breakthroughs being reported. We'd like to thank the committee and urge anyone who would like to contribute to get their efforts to get in touch."
A Warwickshire turkey farmer rode more than 3,000 miles across the Atlantic in memory of his son. Barney Adlington was just 3 when he died in 2005 from meningitis. 18 years on, his dad Rod led a team in the Epic Challenge, raising more than £125,000 for Get Ahead and Meningitis Now. The Brightside's crew, named after Barney's favourite song by the band The Killers, completed the 3,200-mile unassisted crossing from the Canary Islands to the Caribbean in 52 days and 18 hours. They were the first mixed crew and fastest team to complete the CMAP Atlantic Dash Regatta, one of the world's toughest endurance challenges. Rod, who runs Adlington Turkey Farms in Balsall Common, was joined by arable farmer Guy Minchell from Kenilworth, serving paratrooper Alex Perry, and Lancashire vet Anna Williams. Rod said, "I feel amazing. It's just incredible that we made it. The weather was truly awful at times and we endured some real battles. There were moments when we questioned if we would make it, and we worried that food supplies were running low. The winds we encountered stopped us dead in our tracks at points on the crossing, but all we kept thinking was that we didn't want to stop or have to be rescued, so we just battled on the best we could. I think the worst moment was when we had to row backwards to make sure we hit the wind in the right direction, so that we could move forwards again." They set off from the island of Lanzarote on January the 3rd in their boat named Mrs. Nelson. They then rowed non-stop in two-hour shifts for the duration of the journey, which ended on February the 25th when they arrived in Jolly Harbour, Antigua. The team faced significant storms, waves as high as 30 feet, challenging wind conditions, flying fish, seasickness, sleep deprivation, and severe blistering to the hands during the voyage. They also experienced magnificent sunsets, multiple close encounters with dolphins and whales, and Rod celebrated his 58th birthday while at sea. The crossing took longer than I anticipated due to testing weather and unpredictable sea conditions, but the Brightsides are still the fastest crew to have completed the CMAC Atlantic Dash in 52 days, 18 hours and 23 minutes. Tom Bromwich, Chair of Trustees at Get Ahead, which supports with people with head and neck disease, said, "We could not be prouder of Rod and the crew. What they've achieved over the last few weeks is truly remarkable."
Coventry City Council has objected to plans for a nearly 1,000-home development close to the city. The council said more traffic modelling needs to be done to show how it would affect local roads if the scheme is built. Plans for the 970-home development and a new relief road some 8 miles from the city were submitted last year. Documents on Solihull Council's planning portal show Coventry Council's response this week to plans for the neighbourhood, which would be built at Station Road in Balsall Common. Coventry is one of the groups being consulted on the scheme, as it is a neighbouring planning authority. The council initially objected in August 2023, as it had not been shown that the scheme would not have a severe impact on the operation and safety of Coventry's local highwork network, the response said. Along with traffic fears, there were also concerns about the public transport strategy and travel plan. But while a technical note has now been submitted, showing the junctions the scheme could offer, no other work, such as traffic modelling, has been done to assess it further. The new neighbourhood would include affordable and retirement housing, plus a community building, a primary school and a public open space, according to the application. An outline application for the scheme was submitted by Harris Strategic Land and Colchurch Properties Limited in July last year. The plans are still awaiting a decision by Solihull Council.
Controversial plans for a huge solar farm on Greenbelt land in Coventry have been refused. Members of the council's planning committee voted against the scheme by 3-2 last week. Plans for the 60,000 panel solar farm on farmland by Lentons Lane were submitted by the City Council, which owns the land, last year. But the bid sparked an outcry from locals living near the fields, with hundreds signing petitions against the scheme and more than 60 formal objections lodged. In papers for the meeting, council planning officers recommended the scheme be approved, saying its benefits outweighed harm to the Green Belt. The report noted that this would have been subject to the Secretary of State not intervening, and some of the site falls within Rugby Borough Council's boundary too. But after an hour and a half of debate, in which councillors commented on the difficulty of the decision and heard from a range of speakers, members of the planning committee voted against granting the scheme permission. Reasons for the decision included the loss of greenbelt land, the closeness to residential areas, and impact on a local farmer who said he would lose his livelihood if the solar farm went ahead.
A school in Coventry for children with extra learning needs is becoming an academy. Baggington Fields School is joining a group called Thrive Education Partnership. The school helps children aged 11 to 18 who have different kinds of learning difficulties. Baggington Fields was recognised for its work with a recent Good rating by Ofsted. Alison Francis, the head teacher, said, "Joining Thrive Education Partnership is a milestone for us. It enables us to broaden our impact and enhance educational opportunities for our pupils. We're very excited about the opportunities this collaboration will bring to our school community." Thrive Education Partnership says it is happy to join forces with Baggington Fields School. They work with lots of schools to help children who learn differently and say they want to share ideas and things that help children learn better. The CEO of Thrive Education Partnership, Richard Chapman, commented on the new partnership, saying, "The inclusion of Baggington Fields School into our trust is a perfect match. Its dedicated staff and commitment to special education not only aligns with our vision and values, but also opens up new avenues for professional development and inter-school cooperation." They say the partnership represents a shared commitment to improving the educational landscape for students with special educational needs, ensuring they have access to the highest quality education and support.
Outlook News.
Thanks very much, Elaine, for being the bedrock of the news, as always. This week. I've got a couple of public notices to read out. First of all, a request that we've had here that somebody asked us to put on the programme. And it reads this. "Hello, I'm a partially sighted man based in Finham, Coventry, who's looking for a sighted gym buddy to join him at the village gym in Coventry. I'm flexible on times and dates. It'd be great if it could be three times a week. I do have limited eyesight, so some guidance would be appreciated. However, I will more than happily cover membership and fuel costs. Please contact JAG on 07792 581465." So have a think about that. Moving on, I have the lighting up times, we used to call them. Sunrise this week is at 6:40 a.m. and sunset at 5:55 p.m. And now... it's news from the Resource Centre. Yes. Here's Joe this week.
Hello, thank you very much indeed. Yes, each time I come, there's a few weeks in between, and the evening darkness, dusk times get longer, so it's very noticeable at the moment, I think. Hello, everybody. Good to be speaking with you again, which of course means that Hugh is off having a good time somewhere. He's off on holiday this week, sunning himself, so we hope he's had a good time. So I'm back to tell you the news from the Resource Centre here in Earlsdon. Firstly, I'd just like to say how lovely it was yesterday and today to meet one or two people at our new community groups out in the local areas in Coventry. Yesterday I met lovely Lisa and Dom in the Binley group, and today, earlier today, I met lovely Linda at the Holbrooks group. So It's been really great. Coody has managed to get 4 local community groups started. 2 have run this week and 2 will run over the next 2 weeks. We have a group starting in Canley on the next Tuesday, the 12th of March. I think that's running in the afternoon, 1:15. And then we have a group starting after that in Bell Green, that's the afternoon one. CV2, Bell Green group, will meet at 1:15 on the 20th of March. And the Canley group, CV4, is meeting on Wednesday next week from 2 till 4. So great that we've managed to get those underway, and it was lovely to meet Linda and Dom and Lisa at the very first groups, and I think that's all gone very well so far. It's been nice chatting to people, finding out a bit more about what their needs are, what they'd like from us, and linking people up with each other in their local home areas. So that's been really nice. So if you haven't yet found out and you'd like to know a bit more, by all means give us a call here at the centre and ask for Coody, or any of us can tell you a bit more about what's going on. And we'd love to have your ideas and thoughts about it as we go forward. The other thing that's happening next week on Tuesday the 12th is there is a volunteers fair being run on the 12th in Canley. It's actually being run by the Coventry Voluntary Action Group, and we will be attending that. Chris will be going with Coody, and then we're very grateful to Joe and Carol volunteers who are helping out in the afternoon. So we'll be there presenting our charity and the work that we do to whoever tends to turn up, looking for volunteers as we always are, but just making sure that people out in local areas know about the charity and the sort of support we provide. So quite a lot going on out in the community, which is lovely. In terms of other things happening here, well, there's been a lot of work going on. I'd like to just give a big shout out, a thank you to Jeff and to his handyman colleague, Mick. They've been ploughing through a load of jobs over the last months, and they are making a real difference to some of the little things here at the centre that tend to go wrong or we have difficulty getting repaired. They've been working their way through a long list of jobs. Latest ones, I think, are we've had door closers put on the rear door of the building in the Resource Centre and the front door of Boston Lodge, the internal door, so we don't just keep leaving doors wide open in the cold. And that's been great. They've also done a really nice job on sprucing up the information board at the front of the building. And they've just finished painting it in our blue colour, the blue of our brand. So it looks really striking. So big thank you to Jeff and to Mick for all their hard work. Also, Carl asked me to send thank you out to our drivers. Many of you know our many drivers, the volunteers. They all give up their time happily and willingly, and we're very grateful to them. So when you get a chance, if you want to add your thanks, feel free to do so. Things happening here, a couple of fundraising things. I think I mentioned some weeks back Rosie's 5p jar, which is in reception, which, if you remember, Rosie used to keep that jar in her office and used to just put all her loose change in it and collected it each time. That's nearly half full now. So keep bringing your 5p's in and we'll count that out and find a creative way of spending the money at the end of it. And we'll keep that running. So it's in reception. Ask Carol or Heather if you can't find it. But it is on the side as you come through. And the very exciting thing is we were given by Coventry Lions, we're very grateful, we were given a giant Easter egg, as we are most years. It is really big. I mean, I could eat that lot quite quickly, I'm sure many could, but it is very big, and it's lovely decoration on it. So it's basically forming a raffle. So win the giant Easter egg. All you have to do is contribute £1 and choose a football team, which is on the long list of teams that we have printed out. If you want to do £1 for one choice, or however many pounds you want to spend on it. Don't quite know when the draw will happen, but presumably just before Easter, which is April, isn't it? The middle week of April? Second week of April?
First week of April.
First week. Yeah. So there's a bit of time left, so if you want to contribute and be in with a chance of winning it, then please talk to reception. And then the other couple of things I was going to mention, We have a couple of fundraisers coming up, which might be fun, actually. Very grateful to Annette Ball for continuing to support the charity with her musical events and talents. She's involved in organising a spring concert on the 19th of March. That's a Saturday, I believe. No? I think it's the 19th. And that will be at Bethel Church. 16th of March, I think it is, actually. Mm. I'll have to check the date, but it's a spring concert.
Yeah, 16th is next.
16th
next
is Saturday, isn't it?
This Saturday week.
Yeah. And there are tickets still available, or you can turn up in the night, in the afternoon at the door. Please ask at reception if you're not sure, or give us a call. Tickets are £10, and there's a big venue, so there might be quite a lot of people. And I think they're concentrating on music for children, children's pieces. So that sounds lovely. The orchestra and piano, I think. So if you want to go along to that. And looking ahead a little bit further, we have the Leofrit Lions are organising their annual, what used to be called Walkathon, and has now been renamed as the Move for Fun, because you can go in, you don't have to walk, you can wheel, you can push, you can not drive exactly, but you can pedal around in some way. You can go around in a wheelbarrow if you really want to. So they don't mind how you get around, but they run this event in the Memorial Park, Sunday the 19th of May. And it's the 27th year they've been organising this event, and they get a lot of money in for charity. So they split the money afterwards for quite a number of charities, including ourselves. Now, we'd quite like to get a team up. We've got a very active walking group here now, so people in the walking group might want to join in with this. We thought we'd get a CRCB team together, and we'll enter as a whole. The event runs starting at 10 a.m. Or assembling at 10 a.m. for a 11 a.m. start. So we will register a team. If you're interested in being part of that team, please let reception or one of us know, and we will create a list of who's up for it and create a team and put some fundraising efforts together. I think they might quite like mascots for the teams, so if anyone has a real burning passion to be the mascot on the day, and there might even be a fancy dress, we're not sure yet. So it sounds like it'll be fun anyway, and hopefully the weather will be a little bit warmer by then. So I think that's all the things I wanted to mention, so just sending my best to everybody, and speak to you all soon.
Thank you very much, Joe. As usual, lots going on.
Thank you.
Our intrepid sports reporter, Sarah, says her vision is improving, but not quite enough to bring you a report this week. So this is the perfect opportunity to let you know what's on in March. Here's Nigel.
So, yes, I've got some things, What's On, from a magazine called What's On, funnily enough. It doesn't say give you a lot of information in terms of price and things like that, but it does tell you what the dates of things and which theatres, and I've got some telephone numbers for you at the end. So, starting in some sort of chronological order, Tuesday the 12th of March at the Albany Theatre, Antiques and a Little Bit of Nonsense. It's Tales from the Sales Room and television programmes and things like that. On the 14th of March, that's a Thursday, Coventry Building Society Arena, Kids to Adults Middle, dedicated to children and young people with diabetes or additional needs. Now, on Friday the 15th, at the Coventry Building Society Arena again, former police officer, now great storyteller, Colin Sutton, recounting stories of his life, and I've heard some of these on the radio, and they really are very entertaining. Saturday the 16th of March at the Belgrave, As She Likes It, a darkly comedic explosion of multimedia, verbatim, cabaret and drag. Saturday the 16th, 23rd, again at the Belgrade, The Glass Menagerie. I'm sure a familiar title there. It's Tennessee Williams' semi-autobiographical masterpiece. Also on Saturday the 16th at the Coventry Cathedral this time, International Film Orchestra playing music of John Williams and Star Wars. Tuesday the 19th, Coram Shakespeare Schools Festival. There are bridge Shakespearean productions performed by schools locally. On Wednesday the 20th, Albany Theatre, Divorced, Beheaded, Died. It's one-man performance acting as Henry VIII. Thursday the 21st and Friday the 22nd at the Belgrade, Peak Stuff, three fast-paced and funny stories about consumer culture. Friday the 22nd also at the Rialto, Dolly Parton versus Kenny Rogers. Also on the 22nd at the HMV Empire, Guns to Roses. Saturday the 23rd at the Albany Theatre in Coventry here, the Dublin Legends. Wednesday the 27th, again at the Albany, Wanted. It's a drama exploring stories of five extraordinary women. Again at the Albany on Thursday the 28th, the Comedy Store Players, improvised show from the stars of Whose Line Is It Anyway? Friday the 29th and Saturday the 30th, again at the Albany, The Haunting of Blaine Manor. This is a classic ghost story performance. And finally, on Saturday the 30th at the Belgrade, The Last Days of Disco. Now, I know very little more than that, because that's the information that came in from the magazine. What I can give you is telephone numbers, how to contact these various locations. Firstly, the Albany Theatre. That's, they're all, of course, 024, so I'll just go into the rest of it, 02476. It's 02476-998964. The Belgrade, 553-055. Coventry Building Society Arena, 933-444. HMV Empire, 315-415. Now, the Rialto, strangely, on their website, don't give a telephone number, so I'm not quite sure how one contacts them. I leave that to your devices and your best ingenuity. That's all I can tell you for about March 5th for this month.
It's now time for Dave and your postbag, so let's hear your messages for this week.
This is Postbag. Join in the discussion.
Hello there, welcome to your postbag. It's nice to talk to you, and it's lovely to hear from you too. So a big hello to new listener Elizabeth, and new member of the Monday Club. At the club, she told me that she's been telling people for years that there was a Miller's Brook behind where Primark is now. But then a friend told her that there is a Miller's Brook in Wycombe joining the River Sow. So Elizabeth thought she'd been telling people wrong for years. But then another member of the Monday Club told her that Miller's Brook was just behind Riley Square in Bell Green, or still is there. So where is it, or where was it? If you know, please let Elizabeth know. We also welcome back Sarah to Postbag with some good news. Sport is coming back soon, and that is good news, because of the enthusiastic way she puts the sport across. You can't help being interested. And first she tells us of the problem with her eyes.
Hello, lovely listeners. No, you haven't tuned into the wrong bit of the tape or the stick. This is Postbag, not sport. But I just wanted to say a huge apology for not bringing you sport for a second week. I really am sorry about this, but basically I've got some kind of thing going on with my tear ducts, so that instead of blinking out lovely clear fluid, I am blinking horrible dense murky stuff and spreading it all over my eyeballs, which means I can't see very well. Apologies if you're eating your tea. Anyway, I shall be back next week. In fact, I'm putting together an absolute smorgasbord of sporting trivia. Anyway, that's me for now. Now back to your proper postbag. Bye.
Well, I'm looking forward to hearing you do the sport again soon, Sarah. And so is Doreen Hilton.
Hello, this is Doreen Hilton again. Very sorry, Sarah, to hear that you're not with us this week, but I'm sure it'd be nice when you come back again and we can hear your lovely sweet voice on the football. Although I'm not a footballer keen on it myself. It's nice to hear you for others to listen to. I think you do very well. I hope your vision gets better soon, and we'll be very pleased to hear you back, to hear your lovely sweet voice. Okay, Sarah, get well soon. Doreen Hilton. Bye.
Thank you, Doreen. Positive comments like that mean a lot to presenters like Sarah and also listeners alike. Now, Julia's latest report is concerned with how your sight problem is perceived by others, especially by children, which you may have your own observations about and experiences. It's entitled, How to Scare Your Kids. My friend Wendy the Warden came round the other day. Guess who she brought with her? It was her twin grandchildren, Chase and Elsie. I expect you're all thinking the same as my friend John. Wendy the Warden has grandchildren? Surely she's not old enough. Well, she is. And they are only 4 years old and a bit nervous about meeting people. Wendy says I should feel them as I couldn't see them. She explained to the children that my eyes do not work. Chase came over and I felt his hair and how tall he was. Elsie was next and she had lovely hair and a beautiful party frock. Wendy was taking them to Little Red Riding Hood. Anyway, when it was time to go home, Wendy said, Kiss Auntie Julia goodbye. And Chase said, No, I'm frightened because she's got no eyes. Oh, how we laughed. I wonder how they got on with Little Red Riding Hood and the big bad wolf who dressed up as Granny. Imagine how they would have felt if my friend John had been there. They would still be shivering in the corner. Don't have nightmares, everyone. Happy February, Julia. Yes, what are children's reactions to your sight problem? Are they helpful to you? Children can be very adaptable. I took a flying saucer to show a blind lady once, and my mum was worried that she'd be upset that she couldn't see it, so I just knew what to do, so I just put it into her hands. Edwina has been giving plenty of tips on how to do things despite not being able to see. She has found a certain make of soup helpful that it keeps its lid on despite being opened.
Hi everybody, I've got some news about soups. Sounds a bit boring, but actually it's something that's quite a surprise to me. I've only just found out myself. The mate Cross and Blackwell, Cross with an E in it, he's a very old British mate, by the way. I remember the name. And what happened was that I'd gone in for my usual soups in a big store and they had run out. So I decided to try that mate. Now what the big surprise was, as I opened the tin with the pull ring, it only opens halfway and you then tip your soup out. That means that the lid is still intact on the tin and you can just put the tin in the bin. Whereas on an ordinary pull top, it comes off completely and you have to contend with a messy separate lid and put it into the bin and then have to wash your hand under the tap. It makes a big difference, believe me. I just thought I would let you know. Take care, everybody. Bye.
And Edwina gave me a demonstration, and the lid only opened halfway. Doreen Hilton really appreciates Edwina's tips.
Hello, everybody. This is Doreen Hilton again. Nice of our postman to, we have a little chat over the phone before he puts me on, our Dave. What I'd like to come over with this time is Edwina, I'm very, very grateful, Edwina, for all your comments that you've come over the CVS on. I have been listening very carefully, and I thought the last one which you gave was the ladies' outfits and the colours that they wear for spring and summer. You give Doreen here, get up off the backside and sort your wardrobe out. Get rid of the old and buy the new. That's what Doreen's been doing this week. Give the ones you don't want into the charity shop and they will make some pennies and it comes in through for the charities. So I must thank you very, very much, Edwina, for what you have put across. All your little, not just your last comment you made on dresses, but the little tips you gave across too. Very nice of you, very kind. Thank you, Doreen Hilton.
Thank you, Doreen, and for your messages this week. Please, let's hear from you next time. Bye for now.
This is Outlook. You can contact Postbag.
Our website is www.talkingnewspaper.org.uk. Our email address is postbag@talkingnewspaper.org.uk. Join in the discussion on Postbag.
And that was Dave with your Postbag for this week. While we're now in March with spring just round the corner, Elaine completes her loose links to February, which she started last week.
How about leaping? Loose link, very loose link number 3, is to childhood fun, leaping over a brook. Nearest to here is Canley Brook. Canley Brook rises in Duggins Lane on the outskirts of Coventry. A 1 mile section of the brook runs by the side of Torrington Avenue, flows underground in a culvert before it emerges by the railway bridge in Wolf Road. The brook disappeared from view in the 1950s when it was covered over to allow the construction of industrial buildings. As it reappears into the light, the brook meanders across the open fields in Canley, providing a valuable habitat for wildlife, which includes the endangered water vole. Flowing through Prior Derham, it passes the birthplace of Sir Henry Parkes, at the bottom of Moat House Lane. It continues its journey, flowing under the busy A45 highway, where it changes its direction as it crosses the well-kept lawn of Hursall Golf Club. But within a short distance, the environment changes dramatically. The neatly trimmed lawn is replaced by the beautiful natural habitat of the historic Canley Ford, with its sunken lane lined by gnarled oak trees. The ford is a hidden oasis for wildlife. The brook divides into two streams, tumbling over a rock waterfall before it meets the sunken lane to create the ford crossing point. The abundance of water around the ford attracts rare birds such as the kingfisher, which feed on the small fish found in the brook. Leaving the ford, the brook crosses the A45 once more, flowing near to the Canley Hamlet Conservation Area. The hamlet is a small cluster of attractive, well-preserved, high-quality 18th-century farm buildings. This area formed the heart of Canley for hundreds of years. But in 1930s, the focal point for Canley changed, when Coventry City Council constructed the housing and shops in Prior Derham. Canley Brook now heads towards Warwick University campus, flowing behind a series of lakes in the shadow of the Tockhill Woods. It moves onto open farmland as it crosses the ancient Arden landscape, changing direction to veer away from Kenilworth. It is at this point that Canley Brook meets Finnan Brook. Finnan Brook flows towards Coventry for about 2 miles, where it enters the grounds of Finnan Sewage Works, owned by Severn Trent. Here, the water from the brook is used to cleanse and treat the sewage effluent for most of Coventry. On leaving the sewage works, the cleansed water is discharged directly into the River Sow, which flows a short distance to the village of Stoneleigh. Stoneleigh has strong historical links with Canley. For nearly 500 years, the land that Canley is built upon was owned by the family of Lord Lee, whose ancestral home is the magnificent Stoneleigh Abbey. Lord Lee was an important man who became the Lord Mayor of London in 1558. Coventry Council purchased a large area of farmland from the Lee family in 1926. This enabled the council to extend its southern boundary to make Canley, Tyre Hill, Westwood and Finham districts of Coventry. After Stoneleigh, the River Sow rejoins the River Avon, which eventually flows across England to join the mighty River Severn. The water from the Severn reaches the sea in the Bristol Channel, where it becomes part of the Atlantic Ocean. Imagine that little drop of water from Coventry going all that way. So, leaping back to Canley Brook, where there will be signs of spring, to finish, I've linked in a poem by Richard Tideman called Hope. Month of light, says one old writer. Days are longer, mornings brighter. Even birds begin to sing. Winter's turning into spring. Now the snow and ice are melting. Welcome drops of rain are pelting. In these 28 days clear comes the turning of the year. On England's pleasant pastures green, new signs of life are clearly seen. Who fears the dark satanic mills when buds are on the daffodils?
As we remember February, one of its special features was the addition of the extra day, the 29th, because this year is a leap year. But why do we have leap years? Nigel's been looking into the origins and traditions of this extra day.
As it does every 4 years, February has given us an extra day in 2024. But what's the story behind this calendrical oddity? Well, because if we didn't, we'd eventually be eating our Christmas turkey in the summer sunshine. As the Earth doesn't orbit the Sun in exactly 365 days, it's actually 365.2422, a day is added to the calendar every 4 years to make up for those pesky extra quarters, otherwise the seasons would slip out of sync. Those clever ancient Egyptians realised that a year was 365 1/4 days long and allowed extra days at the end of their year to compensate. The Romans followed suit until Julius Caesar revamped the calendar and opted for 2 24 Februaries every 4 years. By the 16th century, important festival dates had drifted, so Gregory the 13th of Gregorian calendar fame dropped 10 days from October 1582 and replaced the double 24th of February with a 29th day instead. Well, are leap years every 4 years then? Well, no, they're not actually. Adding 29th of February actually makes the calendar longer by about 44 minutes. And over a few centuries, that amounts up enough to throw the seasons out of whack as well. So here's the rule. If a year is divisible by 100, but not by 400, there is no leap year. There wasn't one in 1900, and the next time it skipped will be 2100. So it's 200 years difference, and we just miss out the 29th of February that year. So what happens if you're born on the 29th of February? You're known as a leapling, or a leaper, which doesn't sound quite as cute. Notable leaplings include the late great actor Joss Ackland, James Ogilvy, who's 58th in line to the throne, American rapper Ja Rule, Weekend Food columnist Ellie Kershaw, EastEnders and Sex Education actress Iraqi Thakra, and retired footballer Darren Ambrose. Does this mean Iraqi and Darren turn 9, or today, or 40? If you're being pedantic, you'll have had 9 birthday anniversaries, and on Leaping's Facebook groups, people give their ages as, for example, 9/40. Spare a thought for Paul Leaping Frederick in Gilbert and Sullivan's The Pirate of Penzance. The young pirate apprentice discovers that serving his masters until his 21st birthday actually means being stuck on board until he's in his 80s. When do Leapings celebrate their birthday in non-leap years? They're generally divided between 28th of February and the 1st of March, obviously, according to posts on Facebook groups. When asked, answers range from, I was born on the last day of February, not the first day of March, and I'm a strict Februarian, to my parents say I wasn't born yet on 28th of February, so it's 1st of March for me. Several replies with a cheery both. How many Leapings are there? Well, there are around 5 million globally. It's unusual. The probability of being born on the 29th of February is 1 in 1,461, but coincidences do happen. When two neighbours in the town of Anthony, Texas, realise they are both Leapings, they set up a birthday club. Word spread, and the tiny US town, now known as the Leap Year Capital of the World, hosts Leaplings from far and wide at its quadrennial two-day festival. Is it a global tradition? Well, no, not everywhere, but the date has significance in various countries. In Denmark, for instance, if a woman proposes and the man refuses, he must buy her 12 pairs of gloves to hide her ringless finger. In Finland, if a man says no, he must buy the disappointed lady fabric for a skirt, for the reason of which is unknown. While in Greece, getting wed in a leap year is considered unlucky. Why is it called leap year? Not everyone calls it that. Alternatives are intercalary year or bisextile year. Best stick with leap year then. Some say it's because the calendar leaps forward by 2 days in the following year rather than the one in a normal year. Others suggest it's because women have been leaped over on the marriage front and can get their revenge by proposing. And do leap years feature in popular culture? Yes, the aforementioned Pirates of Penzance is one of Gilbert and Sullivan's best loved operettas. Less well loved is the 2010 film Leap Year, starring Amy Adams as an uptight New Yorker who, stranded in rural Ireland en route to propose for her beau, falls for a local instead. The rom-com was branded awful in The Guardian's one-star review. Why does it have to be in February? Well, an additional day during the sunny summer would be lovely, but as February is the shortest month, that's where it's gone. Nice to have an extra day's pay, though. Well, if you're paid daily or hourly, then yes, but those on an annual salary will be technically working for free. In 2016, this annoyed 15,856 people enough to sign a petition calling for the 29th of February to be a bank holiday, but the government wouldn't comply. It said extra bank holidays cost the economy more than $1 billion and pointed out the number of working days in any one year is also affected by other matters, such as the day on which New Year's Eve falls. And finally, how should we mark the occasion? With a drink. Legendary bartender Harry Craddock, author of the Savoy Cocktail Book, devised a special cocktail for the London Hotel's 1928 Leap Day celebrations. So, mix gin, Grand Marnier, and sweet vermouth with lemon juice and raise a glass to the oddest day of the year.
Not many of us will be around for the missed leap year in 2100. That great orator, that great creator of Dame Edna Everage and Sir Les Paterson, Barry Humphreys, died last April. And Bill started recounting his history and career last week, which he now completes in this article. Farewell, Possum.
Few stars have had international careers as varied as Barry Humphreys. Just one programme, it's frankly impossible to cover all his successes since his birth in 1934. So, Radio 2 Remembers Barry Humphreys is a whistle-stop tour of his 89 years, with some wonderful rarities and glorious surprises along the way. These include an extract from Edna's first commercial disc and her much later collaboration with composer Carl Davis. Song of Australia is a musical history of Australia, seen through Edna's Piemonte spectacles. Involving a full orchestra and choir, it was first performed at the Royal Albert Hall. Steve Wright was a fan of the Australian comedy legend, with both Dame Edna and Barry appearing on his Radio 2 show many times over the years. He reveals, "I knew Barry just a little bit. We kind of got each other, really. What a unique person, and what a comic genius." In April 2023, Radio 2 listeners lost their trusted guide for the music and performers of the past. Barry Humphries is much missed behind the scenes at this network, and on air, he's irreplaceable. "He was such a rare bird," says radio critic Gillian Reynolds, who wrote many glowing reviews of Barry's vintage music shows. "He made characters that were timeless, yet of our time. I could really identify people in my own family, as well as bits of myself. It's an extraordinary gift." Barry's turntable time machine, running at a speed of 78 RPM, transported listeners back to a time before most of us had been born, and offered a really thrilling ride. One highlight was when Barry decided to broadcast from Dame Edna's yacht. He said it was his alternative version of Radio Caroline. Instead of the sound of the future, Radio Phyllis brought listeners reassuring sounds of the past. Noteworthy songs included "Don't Tell My Mother I'm Living in Sin," sung by Elsa Lanchester, "Fiddling with the Knobs on the Radio" by music hall star Dorry Dean, and "Other People's Babies" by Nora Howard. Barry was a real culture vulture. His home was full of books, records and paintings. While on tour, he usually spent his rest days hunting for bargains in second-hand bookshops or visiting art galleries. He was also a gifted artist, by the way. "I paint very beautiful landscapes. I sit with an easel and canvas in all weathers. I've had a few exhibitions. I've earned a living from it," he once said. During his final days in hospital, Barry was making jokes right to the end. He was entertaining family, his wife Liz Spender, friends and nurses, with tales of the Grim Reaper stalking hospital corridors, looking for victims while dressed in a hoodie. He was a consummate entertainer, not least because he left everybody wanting so much more. The lesson I take from the great and incomparable Barry Humphries is this: make the most of every moment, it may be your last. This is reminiscent of the sentiment of one of Barry's favourite songs, "Are You Having Any Fun?" sung by fellow Australian Chip Huntley. It reminds those who hear it that the pursuit of money should come second to having fun. This fits so well with something Barry often said: never be afraid to laugh at yourself, because you could be missing out on the joke of the century. Barry died at St. Vincent's Hospital in Darlinghurst, Sydney, on April 22nd. The previous year, he'd expressed a wish to be remembered first and foremost as a radio personality. Given Barry's wide-ranging talents and international fame, it might at first seem strange. Yet, without the wireless supplying little Barry the all-important gateway to a world of entertainment far away, perhaps none of us would be so familiar with the name Barry Humphries, or indeed, Dame Edna Everidge. When I was growing up, Radio 2 was a near constant companion in the background of my life, filling it with lovely music and the warm, friendly voices of David Jacobs, Barry Wogan, John Dunn and Sheridan Morley, and latterly, Barry Humphries. Those great names may have gone, but the station remains a national treasure, the ability to reach into homes, lifting spirits in dark times. Today, it's Zoe Ball, Vernon Kay, Sarah Cox and Johnny Walker, and the rest of Radio 2 presenting family, doing just that.
Many, if not most of us, have little problems, so wheelchairs are nothing to be ashamed of. Kevin Garside writes about how a life lesson inspired Hannah Cockcroft's fast track to glory in his article from The Independent, read by Sue.
Hannah Cockcroft is anxious. That's a good thing. It means the primal drivers that have made Britain's preeminent wheelchair athlete the woman to beat since her Paralympic debut at London 2012 are still vital. At 31, she will be among the oldest competitors in Paris. A swarm of ambitious rivals, some known, some ready to announce themselves as the year unfolds, are circling. This, of course, is the way of things, but maturity is no impediment to big match apprehension, no matter how many records broken or medals won. This time of year, you feel a bit lost, she says, from her home in Chester. We've not raced for a few months. New girls can come out, some have new race chairs, which can make a massive difference to their speeds, how they push. And ultimately, you have no idea where you are or where they are. It's the scary time. If it's scary for her, imagine how her rivals must feel. Cockcroft began last year with a slew of world records in Dubai over 200 metres, 400 metres, 800 metres and 1500 metres before lowering the bar over 100 metres at the World Championships in Paris. Nevertheless, Cockcroft is, believe it or not, human, and with that comes doubt. With the name, there's expectation. People see me on the start line and go, oh, Hannah's here, she'll win. It's kind of not that simple now. I'm 31, which is quite old in athletics terms. My main rivals are in their early 20s. The anxiety is constantly there. Cockcroft has come to accept her role as a disabled icon, the importance of which would not be lost on the young Hannah, who reviled her chair because of the separation it confirmed. She neither knew nor saw other wheelchair users. It was almost a point of shame that fell away only when Mrs. Daniels, her former teacher in Halifax, brought a disabled basketball team to school. An episode Cockcroft, aged 15 at the time, acknowledged changed the course of her life. I hated my wheelchair. I avoided it. I didn't see people on telly. I had no friends with disabilities at all. There were moments when I felt completely alone. There were so many things I couldn't do. She literally changed my life with one lesson plan. I can hand on heart say that without Mrs. Daniels bringing in that basketball team, I would not be here now, doing a completely different sport 16 years later. I talk about this a lot. The thing she taught me was my wheelchair was not something to be ashamed of. That acceptance of who I am and what I can do was the opening to a whole new world. Before and after Mrs. Daniels, there was and is her parents, whose unwavering source of unconditional love and support enabled young Hannah to seize every opportunity. Their daughter survived two cardiac arrests at birth that left her technically dead for 20 minutes. She suffered damage to her brain and nerve endings, has weak hips, deformed legs and feet, and poor fine motor skills. Her handwriting isn't the best, and tying shoelaces is a challenge. Now, Cockcroft means the world to all those who see her, punching a wheelchair-shaped hole through the barriers. When I started wheelchair racing, I used to see the attention in a negative way. When you meet a kid now and they go, I saw you on telly, that's why I wanted to start, I think, what a privilege that is. How much I wish I had someone to look up to like me. That's worth more than a gold medal, because you make someone a little less ashamed of something you should not be ashamed of. Cockcroft often ponders how her life might have evolved had she been able-bodied. She concludes it would not have led her to Olympic success, to the Strictly dance floor, to Celebrity Bake Off, or the set of Countryfile. If I didn't have a disability, I wouldn't have been an athlete, or have achieved 1% of what I have achieved. I would have gone to university, got a degree, got a job. Loads of my friends now have a family and still live in Halifax. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. If that had been my life, I would have been so happy with it. But alternatively, I get to travel the world and get to do something I love every day. I think I drew the long straw. Her first championship victory led to a call-up to the post-2008 Beijing Team GB Paralympic squad. Within 3 years, she had set her first world record, the T34 400 metres. And then there was London 2012, where she won gold in the T34 100 metres and 200 metres, lowering the world record in the former. Three more golds followed in Rio and two in Tokyo. In Paris, should she qualify, she will defend her T34 100 metres and 800 metre titles. It doesn't end there. The 2028 Games in Los Angeles remain a target. But sport is only part of the story. As well as embellishing her legend in Olympic year, Cockcroft has a marriage to attend in October, her own, and she's also selling her home. Melding life with a packed schedule is the price of being spectacular. What was once regarded an impairment has become her superpower. Being disabled is not a bad thing, she said. I'm fortunate I have a platform to make that point every day. That is massively important to me.
Margaret has, over the weeks, read many of the pieces by Susie Dent in the Radio Times about the origin of words and phrases. But along with words go accents. And Susie's also investigated why we change our accents depending on who we're with.
A few years ago, academics at the University of London confirmed what West Country farmers have suspected for years, that cows have accents. The study showed that there were distinct tonal variations in moos within different herds, much like our regional dialects. The result is that while one cow might sound proper Somerset, the lingo of Somerset, another might reveal a Lancashire twang. This phenomenon has already been well documented in birds. Sonograms have shown that the Scottish crossbill, for example, manages to attract a mate from the entire crossbill population by adopting a strong Highlands accent. The Cockney quack of a London duck is apparently like a shout and a laugh, while Cornish ducks sound as though they are giggling. A study of thousands of sperm whales revealed that these wondrous animals also communicate in sounds that are bespoke to their clan. The paper published in the Royal Society Open Science Journal describes how sperm whales exchange distinctive Morse code-like sequence of clicks with their peers. Each clan has its own vocalization, and these distinctions are enabling scientists to establish the true number of the groups in our oceans, and their importance goes further. The variations in sound not only confirm membership on a particular group, but also, crucially, keep outsiders out. Sperm whale clans might meet, but they will never interbreed. While that might seem a little extreme in human terms, our own coned tongues are just as useful, and our own sounds are equally key to where we are in the world. We are all adept at code switching, dipping in and out of the vocabularies and even accents depending on who we're speaking to. But we can also slip back into the language of home in a heartbeat, shrugging on our family's words and sounds like a cosy and cherished old jumper. Depending on where we're from, we will no longer feel simply tired, but instead be puggled, folded, lennock, depooperate, or plain dumfungled. Such linguistic loyalty is hard to shake off. But tribe talk goes much further than dialect, overlapping these local terms of thousands of other private lingos that have become the secret languages of Britain. Every sport, every profession, every community, united by a single passion, draws on a lexicon that is uniquely theirs. The thousands of resulting shorthands reflect the needs, ambitions and personalities of the group, and for any anthropologists, they're richly informative. In some circles, including those of spies and Freemasons, secrecy is given. In the military, operational shorthand can be the decider of life and death. When a paramedic blues a patient into hospital with GCS3 and possible ETOH, they are dipping into a standard protocol that is swift, succinct and painless, for them at least, but for the patient is likely to be hammered. Other professionals opt for secrecy for different reasons. Butchers once used a special form of slang known as pig Latin in which to talk about their customers. Thus a drab tross was a bad sort and an fill heath a thief. While cool the dello namo meant look at the old woman and secretly conveyed the fact that this one was highly irritating. Similarly, a waiter might complain of a flea, a bad tipper, whose arms are too short to reach their pocket. There is joy in these unifying languages too. Take builders, whose colourful banter brightens both their day and that of anyone who overhears them. For some of them, a snotter is anything stuck to paint or plaster that shouldn't be. For others, spreading the fat on Lionel Richie's dance floor is plastering the ceiling. Vicar to vicar, talk of tinkering kongs or shoving leopard, the hymns conquering kings and loving shepherd of thy sleep, will guarantee a smile, unless the arched demon is present. Lexicographers have one too. They will speak of lemmas, glosses, passing and eggcorns, slips of the ear that become expressions as in let's cut to the cheese. And as I have found to my cost, any TV presenter who hears they are looking hot on the floor should know not to take it as a compliment. You look too shiny on set. This kind of language is often so instinctive that we fail to notice its differences. If you ask a community of Geordie knitters or a group of Cornish train spotters for their secret shorthands, you may receive nothing but a hard stare. Spend some time eavesdropping in the pub afterwards, however, and you will get the full flavour of tribal lingo. The best time to explore the language of the herd is when it's not looking. The same can undoubtedly be said for Somerset-speaking cows.
Joe Davis is probably known to many of you both as a user and a helper here at the Resource Centre. What you may not know is that she was a military wife, and here she talks about that experience and the royals she has met.
Right, hi everyone, as you know, I'm Jo. I come to the centre because I'm partially sighted as a result of my strokes, but I'm also an ex-military wife. So I used to live in St John's Wood in London, on the King Street Barracks, which is the Queen Mother's husband's regiment. So the royals were quite regular at our barracks and coming to visit, and then also because we were the King's Troop, I don't know if you're aware of them, they're the ones that do a month in Whitehall when the household cab take the horses on holiday. They march in and they're the ones with the blue uniforms with the yellow beading over their uniforms. They do a month at Whitehall, and then the cab come back, they march back in, King Street march back out, and then they take their horses on holiday for a month. And they all go to Norfolk, the horses, and they go on the beach, and they're running through the sea, and they're just free with no reins. They just do what they like for a month. So the horses love it. So, yeah, so all the horses are looked after really, really well. At the King's Troop, we have 6 gun carriages. And so the King's Troop do a lot of ceremonial duties. So at Earl's Court, Windsor, they do the crossover carriages where they've got 6 horses, they're carrying a gun carriage, and they scissor in on each other. And it's very quick, it's very fast, and it's called a gun drive display. And at the end, they fire their guns. The King's Troop are the ones that fire the guns for the Queen's birthday, which now it'll be the King's birthday in the park. Any, like, Trooping of the Colours, it's the King's Troop that fire the guns. So we were on that barracks with the gun carriages. Also at the King's Troop was the coffin carriage. So the carriage that carried Diana, carried the Queen Mother, and also carried the Queen for a short time. The coffin carriage was on our troop as well, and on our barracks. So yeah, everything had to be always cleaned up and everything. I remember quite often we'd be away on show season, and because my husband was in with the Black Horses, which was F-sub, we would be the ones that got called back if there was anything wrong with the royal family, because they had to be on alert in case there was a funeral to be done. So everything had to be clean, the horses had to be ready, the reins had to be sorted, all the tack. We would be away at show season, and can you remember the Queen Mum? She had a fall and broke her hip. She also choked on a fish bone. And then we had Margaret that had a huge drink and set fire to a part of the palace with her cigarette. So we got called back every time those happened, because it was just in case they passed away. So we had to be on hand, ready for the King Street to take the procession. So the first time, probably close up, that I met the royals was the Queen and the Queen Mother at Royal Windsor. We were just arriving, and the King's Troop were doing their ceremonials in the afternoon, so it was lunchtime. And in the morning, the Queen, Queen Mother, Philip, they all went for the morning, and then in the afternoon you had Prince Charles, who now is King Charles, Diana, Fergie and Andrew, they were there for the afternoon. So as we came in, they were just preparing to leave, but just bowed their heads very gracefully as we went past, and they were getting ready to leave. But I was fascinated that with the Queen Mother, with her being of an older age, her skin, I was just fascinated, because she was about the same age as my nan at the time. You know, my nan, bless her, was my idol. And her skin age is, you know, you get wrinkles as you get older and things like this, don't you? But even though they were older and on the telly they looked wrinkled, they weren't when you seen them face to face. It was as if someone had ironed their skin. It was just perfect, you know. And I just couldn't get over it. I was fascinated all the time when I seen them about their skin. I just gazed at their skin all the time. I bet they thought, what's she staring at, you know?
Had a bit of Botox.
Well, yeah, you know, it makes you wonder, doesn't it? I don't know. But I've got a story about this later on, and hopefully you'll see the finished side like the Queen did, God love her. But yeah, so yeah, I was really, really taken back. And then, so before the King's Troop did their gun drive, I walked around. I'd got my son with me. He was only 3 weeks old at the time. And we're walking around, and they have certain little stalls for the army wives to look at and things, you know, while you're waiting for the next person to come into the court to do something. So we were going around the stalls, and all of a sudden I heard two people arguing over my son, saying, no, I want to hold him. No, I'm holding him. No, I'm holding him. And I was thinking, he's arguing over my son. So I turned around from this stall, only to find Diana and Fergie standing at the pram. And Diana said, we're arguing who's going to hold this new baby. Because it is a new baby, isn't it? And I said, yes, it is, Diana. I said, he's 3 weeks old. And she was like, well, it's got to be me. She said, because I'm boy mad. She said, I only wanted boys. And Fergie went, it's not my fault I had girls. And they're arguing over the pram. And Diana said, well, Mum, you'll have to choose. And I went, Fergie, I'm so sorry. It's got to be Diana. And she went, see, I told you, us boys stick together, you know. And she picked up my son and she howled him. Tried to walk off with him a few times. And then eventually she let Fergie hold him. But then she got chatting to me, asking where we lived and how come we were at the show. And I explained that we were the King's Troop and I was one of the wives. And she said, oh, well, I'm sure we're booked in a couple of times to come to your barracks. She said, I'll look out for you. So I said, yeah, okay. Not thinking anything of it, because how many thousands of people did she see in a week? You know what I mean? They must see hundreds of thousands of faces. How are they going to remember one? But to my astonishment, when she did used to come back to the barracks, as soon as she got out of the car, she looked over at the wives and you could see her stretching her neck and she'd walk off. And Burrell was like running after us, sort of thing, you know, like as if she says, I don't know what you're doing, we're supposed to be going this way. And she was saying, oh, sorry, I've just got to go and see your mum. And she comes straight up to us every time and was like, how big is he? And let's have a look. And oh my gosh, have we got any teeth yet? And look at his hair. And, you know, and every time she came to the barracks, she looked for him, you know. And I found that was really, really touching. How can somebody who sees so many people, and this is why I think it affected us as a nation. She definitely was our princess, wasn't she?
And next week, Jo will continue her reminiscences and remember meeting the late Queen. And that brings the end of Outlook for another week. From the team and me, Peter Walters, it's goodbye till next time.